So first, Rebecca, I want to thank you and just say that I think the work you're doing with Silicon Dragon is just fantastic. It's just wonderful. China Institute is really delighted to be partnering with you on stuff. And just a quick 2 seconds on China Institute. We're, I guess you could say, really the only institution in New York, which is we've been around for more than 90 years, and we're devoted to raising understanding and awareness of China through three pillars: education, arts and culture, and business dialogue. So we did a big executive summit in April with Hank Paulson, and Joe Stiglitz spoke, and we did a wonderful event with Rebecca and Silicon Dragon not too long ago, where Gary Reichel spoke, and we do all kinds of programming, so I hope you come often. So I have to say that this book, I'm not finished reading the book yet, but I just have to say that this book is absolutely fantastic. So congratulations, Rosanne. We have 10 minutes. We have 10 minutes, so we got to talk fast. So I'm going to jump right in basically this is a book about women in China, and in particular the women who are so-called leftover women in China. And so you'll explain that in a second, but I just have to ask you, you know, you talked about how one of the reasons you wrote this book was seeing this contradiction around you. And the question is, why is it that so many women find it hard to find a man, basically, and get married when you have a country that has so many more men than women because of the one-child policy?
This was a question that one of the first things that I asked myself when I got to China. I was pretty certain that it was full of contradictions. One of the first things I did was buy a Tiandongche, an electric scooter. And riding around Beijing, I would see contradictions everywhere. I would see buildings going up and then, you know, big flatbed trucks piled high with my side. You know, white cabbage that was being brought in from the provinces. And that was one of the first contradictions. And then, you know, to support my scooter habit, I get a job at a television station, and I'm surrounded by women who are smart, many of them only daughters, many of them from other cities, supporting themselves, you know, in a big city, and single, all of them, and facing tremendous pressure over Chinese New Year, especially because they've not gone home with anyone. And there's a part of me thinking, wait a minute, we all know that by 2020, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences has predicted that there will be 30 million more men of marriage age than women, right, as a result of the one-child policy and the traditional preference for boys. So China should be like a dating oasis. And this was kind of one of the articles that I thought I was going to pitch to maybe an editor at Marie Claire. Except I needed to find those men. Where on earth were they? And surely it would probably, you know, cheer up the mood at the office as well. After New Year was when everyone was kind of licking their wounds from the lacquering of marriage pressure that many of my colleagues had received. And the truth is, you know, one of the sort of unexpected consequences of the one-child policy, of which there are many, is that while over 30 million baby girls are estimated to have been aborted or disposed upon shortly after birth, you saw that families in urban areas of the country were more willing to keep a daughter. And this is very clear in the demographics of China. There are parts of China where, you know, well, Beijing and Shanghai, big cities, that gender imbalance never really exceeds 100 girls for 116, 17 boys, which is indicative of, you know, tampering with the sex ratio. But if you go into more rural areas of the country, it climbs to 120, 130, 140, 150, 100 girls for 170 boys. So those men are in those areas where parents felt the need to have a boy. And these girls were born into families where parents were okay with a girl.
And one of the amazing things about this book, I will say, is that it's really wonderful, wonderful storytelling. And that you were talking about the horrible pressure that these women endure when they go home for Chinese New Year. One of my favorite details was when you talk about the fact that you and your friend go online to see if you could rent a boyfriend to bring home for Chinese New Year, right? And it never really worked out, did it, in that case?
No, so we went on Taobao. She was facing ridiculous pressure from her parents. So we went on Taobao. And this was actually, she's my Chinese teacher, and this was part of my Chinese class. She was like, oh, no, she has, you know, we're going to study characters now. Let's type in the characters in Taobao. And we went through different options, and we even called a few. There was one who claimed to be multilingual, and he was wearing this like arrestingly sparkly suit jacket, and he was rather zealously clutching a giant globe, I guess, to really, you know, hammer on that fact that he was very international. And we called him, and I was kind of, you know, asking him, have you gone home with many women? He said, no, I'm getting a lot of calls, but no one yet. And I don't think he spoke as many languages as he claimed to. And ultimately, she just kind of said, swallow, you know, forget it.
Well, was she the one who actually takes the train home so that she can arrive at night so she doesn't have to talk to the neighbors when she arrives?
Yeah.
Because they're going to ask her about where's your boyfriend and where's your...
She lives at the end of Michelle too, and she refuses to arrive during the day because that means passing all of the Lao Tai Tai, right? All of your old ladies are going to come out and go, "Xiaomishahoujiehoi." So she takes the train to get in at night and avoid it.
Okay, so before, we have just a few more minutes, but before we get into the economics of all this, which we'll talk about at the end, give us a few more insights into the emotional side of love in China. Another fascinating thing, I learned so much from this book. When you talk about wa'aini, you know, I love you, and discovering that that's actually something that people rarely, it seems, say.
Yeah.
So talk about that. What does that mean? What is that all about?
This was also very surprising to me, that, you know, wa'aini isn't something that is very commonly said in China, especially in the past, right? Someone actually said to me, I used to say it to my wife in English, because we felt a detachment from those words. It's just not something that was said in Chinese. And in the book, I get into sort of the linguistic evolution of ai qing, which becomes ai, which then becomes wa'aini. But it's Confucianized, right? This idea that actions speak louder than words. And even though you can have, you know, I love you written on bed sheets and all sorts of things that you can buy around China, those three words in Chinese are still very powerful. And you see a disconnect across the generations. So people born in the 70s just don't bring it up at all. People born in the 80s seem to want to say it more often, but it's not something they do. And the Jolingho, you know, the 90s kids are a bit more trailblazing, and I think it's becoming more common. But I was also kind of, I didn't know what to do with that information.
So talk a little bit about what the calculation is around marriage these days. Is it about love? Is it about money? Is it about personal advancement? Is romantic love the norm these days in the sort of, you know, current generation? Or is marriage really more about kind of practicality?
So it's a mix. Traditionally, it has been practicality, right? It's been meng dang hu dui. It's been matching doors and matching windows. And you know, there were always gifts exchanged when, as in many cultures, right, when marriages were contracted. And those have kind of been upgraded from maybe like a bicycle and a washing machine and an alarm clock in the 70s or the 80s to, you know, a car, a house, and a big bank account, right? So that transactional nature does exist. And the rate at which China's economy has grown has actually reinforced that. Right, because marriage for a woman kind of still could be the ultimate express elevator to a better life if you could marry into that kind of wealth. But what I'm seeing is that, you know, there aren't as many women doing that in China, partially because they have their own resources, right? Those only daughters that were born to parents who decided to keep them gave them all of their resources that they had. They raised them as if they were sons because they didn't have sons. So that meant education, sometimes abroad, it meant inheriting property. So these women have assets of their own, and as a result are less likely to sort of need to marry into them. Of course, there still are, and one of the main characters in the book is a mistress, and she's very good at working her assets to attain other assets.
Yeah.
But I really do see, I mean, in a way, I sort of saw these leftover women as kind of China's crusaders for romantic love. They were unwilling, they were displeased with the pressure that they were facing, but also sort of unwilling to compromise and unwilling to get married unless they really wanted to, because they no longer had to. For the first time, marriage is actually discretionary in China, which has really never been true.
Right. Okay, so a couple quick economic questions, and then I think we have to move on to the next show. But so you mentioned mistresses. One quick economic thing is talk about the mistress sort of economy, the fact that if you're a successful man, you sort of, to show that you have a mistress, and how does that work?
Right, so in China, yes, having a mistress is kind of, as I was told, it's expected once a man has reached a certain status, right? And this is nothing shocking. Mistresses have a long history in China. If you go back to the Forbidden City, there's a history of concubines. And if you look at that well, concubines in the Forbidden City were pretty much the only women who were in the know at the time, right? They had exposure to mandarins and to high-level conversations that women who were married and in home would not get otherwise. So when I approach this mistress sort of equation, I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe they're doing it in exchange for handbags or rent, and it turned out to not be that at all. There are some women in China who are mistresses for those purposes, but many were going after the capital.
Yeah.
Big time investment. And, you know, I interviewed a man, you referred to him as the Lothario, and he very much is, who was kind of desperate to marry one. And the women weren't interested because they could work the assets and the connections and the guanxi of five different men rather than be attached to one, and that just was much better for their bottom line. And so that's
and they were very often starting businesses with this.
They were starting, these were very entrepreneurial
economic
businesses.
Driver.
Yeah.
Okay, so couple quick final questions on economics. One is the unintended consequences thing, which is you write about the sex ratio imbalance and how that then drove property prices in some weird way. So talk about that, and then I'll just throw out the final question, which is just the big picture. You know, the book is it's titled "The Women Shaping the World's Next Superpower." So, you know, talk about what that means in terms of women in the workforce and what kind of role they will play economically.
Sure. So back to the property market, I mean, this is kind of a remnant of the transactional nature of marriages. You know, in China, the ideal is for a woman to marry into a family with a man who has the house, the car, and the cash, and slightly more than he does, right? So this is altered prices in the marriage market. We'll see that as a result of this shortage of women, right, stemming from the imbalances that came from the one-child policy, you have parents who are desperate to find wives for their sons, especially in these rural areas of China where women are just absolutely scarce. And so we've started to see that plays into property. In order to get a matchmaker to come by and consider your son to be someone's potential mate, you can sort of impress them by creating a home which, you know, some researchers found that there was this phenomenon of phantom third-story houses. So a family could afford to build a two-story home, but would put sort of a fake third story to make the home appear larger from the outside and up chances that a matchmaker would come by. And, you know, it sounds comical to think about. He's explaining to me, you know, once they ran out of third stories, they were putting lightning rods on top of their houses. And he thought, they look like crosses. I thought, this is not a religious, you know, very religious country. But that stemmed into the property market, because families feel like in order to attract a wife, they need to own this. And of course, that doesn't always play out because the supply of women isn't there. So that therefore stokes right buying from other countries, right? We're seeing, you know, refugees from North Korea or from Thailand or from Vietnam. A lot of men in rural parts of China have taken to buying wives because there simply aren't enough. While in urban areas with women, you see a very different story play out.
So the role of this awesome new generation of educated women who are single but driving forward with their career.
Well, not perpetually. I mean, just getting married later, and sometimes not at all, but definitely changing, you know, with different timelines for their young adulthood. I mean, I think a lot is riding on their shoulders. You know, Hans was talking about upgrading the offline economy through the internet, and I think a lot of the companies that he mentioned, so Alibaba, Tencent, Meituan, I mean, don't tell me that women aren't big consumers of big products. You know, a lot of these products, the sellers, the buyers, the ones editing photos, they're driving a lot of this, right? So they're going to be an important part going forward as China switches from, an economy where the government's giving out lots of generous loans to one where domestic consumption is becoming a lot more important.
I'm telling you, read the book. It's a fantastic,
fantastic
read.
It was an honor to be here. Thank you.
Terrific book.